things get a little bit grim. But this is especially heinous.
Did you tell the police that she was murdered, May?
Nope.
Witchy ghost stuff.
Ah! That made me scared.
A spooky girl amateur hour.
I watched a TikTok today where a seventh grade teacher asked his seventh graders, what do your parents do that make you cringe?
Oh, God. I don't even want to know. I should ask Theo.
Oh my gosh, you should.
What'd they say?
One of them was like, take mirror selfies.
We invented selfies.
I was like,
We will take selfies whatever which way we please.
Sir. Right. Be grateful that we trailblazed this right. for you.
Why do you think you have like a professional camera in your iPhone 13? Because of us.
I know.
Because of us.
One of them was, my mom calls herself a gangster. And then it was like, girl, no. Oh, God. It was hysterical. I was just like, kids,
the way kids underestimate their parents, because, like, I, in, like, my wayward mm-hmm. days.
Wayward phases.
In my wayward phases, where I was not on the slow and steady path.
Uh-huh.
I met a lot of people who were, like, pretty rough around the edges, we'll say,
uh-huh.
in a nice way, who, like, have kids. One's a teacher now.
Damn.
And I'm like, you used to do coke with strangers at bathrooms. And, right. like, you're teaching first grade.
Yeah.
Don't underestimate your parents. But it makes you wonder about our parents, too.
Listen, I know my mom was a harlot.
Your mom was a real ride-or-die kind of gal.
Absolutely. She told me a story once about how she snuck out of her bedroom window when she was 14 to meet up with her boyfriend and came home with a purposefully placed hickey necklace. She had her boyfriend give her hickeys on her collarbone all the way up so that her mom would see that she had a hickey necklace.
What?
Mother!
Joni! Oh my. I was not that bold.
Oh, my mom was not that bold.
I didn't start sneaking out. I never really snuck out. Let's be, because my mom was sharp as a fucking, like, she
yeah,
was.
She knew.
She was eagle-eyed. She knew I was wayward.
She was just like, you're not dead.
No.
So.
Keeping a close eye on me.
Yeah.
But probably not until I was, like, 17 or 18. And then I'd be like, I'm going to go stay the night with my friend Cecily and then, like, spend the night with my boyfriends or whatever.
Sure. I never snuck out. I did have a bedroom window that would go out onto my roof. And so I would go and sit on my roof,
yeah.
like an emo teenage girl.
Stare at the moon.
Staring at the moon.
Crying about your feelings.
Wishing I had a different life, like yep. a psychopath.
Yeah.
So that was me.
Sure.
But I also could get down because I had one of those, like, antennas. That it's like a, you know, like the triangle ladder
yep.
thingies. So all I had to do was go out my window, down.
And out.
And out. But I was in the middle of freaking nowhere.
Well, you're not going to go away to anywhere.
7 miles from town.
Right.
Like, I'm not going to go anywhere. I'm going to go wander around my own farm.
Right. It's boring.
It was boring. But man, if I had that in a town.
Oh, you'd be
gone. That could have been dangerous.
Yeah. We had me and like my high school hooligan friend. Used to go to parties like when we were like our senior year or whatever. We would just be like, hey mom, we're going to the mall. And she'd be like, okay. And we would go to Fort Wayne
uh-huh.
and go party with like all of our college friends or go to their houses and
yeah.
have like huge and then come back at like 3 a.m. and mom's like, how's the mall? It's like so good.
It's close to 6 hours ago.
I know, so good. So good.
Oh my gosh. We are so lucky that we did not have location services.
No. Oh, no. Because kids now, you're not getting away with that shit.
Sorry, boo-boo. Like, I know my youngest sister has her locations on. And, like, the rule was in high school, her mom had to have her location. Now that she's out of high school, I have to have her location until she graduates college.
Okay. So, Lara doesn't have her.
Lara does not have the location anymore, I don't believe.
Okay.
But there have been times where I've, like, just gone on to be like, wonder where she's at. And I'm like, Miss Ma'am, you turned off your location services.
Did she do it on purpose?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Claire.
Oh, for sure. She,
for
like,
why?
She went MIA one weekend. Like, she was gone for, like, 2 days and turned off her location
services. Is this when she got stuck in Chicago?
No.
Oh.
And I think she went to go spend the night with her boyfriend or something.
Oh my God, she's grown.
Right. But, like, went MIA. And I was like, girl, I don't give a shit where you are. Like, just tell me you're safe.
Right.
Like, your mom's freaking out.
Mm-hmm.
I need to be able to tell her
that you're okay.
That you're okay.
And you just need
to have your eyes on you to make sure that you're not being held against your will.
Thank you.
Or dead. Like, I don't give... You take care of you. I fully believe that you can take care of yourself.
Yes.
Let's calm some fears.
Yeah.
Instead of perpetuating them.
Reduce the anxiety.
Yeah.
Instead of, like, purposefully making it worse.
Right. Like, I could easily have been like, I have laid eyes on her. She FaceTimed me.
Yeah.
She is alive and well.
Did she respond?
Yeah, it was, like, but she responded to everybody at once.
Oh.
So it was, like, me, Laura, Kara, all trying to, like, get a hold of her. And Kara and I were both just like,
bro,
if you don't want to, like, if you don't want your mom to know where you are, fine. I understand that.
Yeah.
You got to let one of us know.
Right. So all three go into a tailspin.
Yeah.
That's not it. Not it, Miss Ma'am. Don't cause your loved ones anxiety. No one cares what you're doing. We just want to make sure that you're doing it alive.
Yeah. We can backtrack bad choices. We can't backtrack if you're dead.
Yeah. I don't care what kind of choices you're making. I just want to make sure you're not dead in a ditch. You can be naked in a ditch. That's fine.
Yeah.
I'll come get you.
As long as it's consensual naked in the ditch. Yes! That's fine.
Thank you. That's all we ask.
Oh, my God. So welcome to March.
Oh, welcome to March. It's first episode of the month because the first is a Tuesday.
Oh, is it March 1st?
March 1st. Today's like March.
Oh my gosh.
I know.
Welcome to March 1st.
March.
We are seeing the end of our winter times here in the Midwest.
The first day of meteorological spring. I mean, it's tornado season.
Oh, snap. Hopefully we don't get any more snow. I'm kind of ready for spring.
Yeah, I'm kind of ready for spring too. I'm going to say we probably are going to get more snow here in the next week just because Ian is doing a project in the garage.
Oh.
So my car is now parked in the driveway.
So we will get more snow.
The first time we did that was when we got those like 16 inches then when we got those like 4 or 5 inches before. So
okay, noted. So
one more snowstorm until Ian's done doing his projects.
Got it.
And then we'll be in the clear.
All right. Yeah, we had like 2 days of like relatively
nice 60
weather.
Yeah,
I did not realize how much my soul needed it.
Yeah,
until I was outside and like driving around in the sunshine and I was just like,
so I have come to realize, despite all of my best efforts, winter, I love winter. I do. It doesn't bring me the same joy it once did.
Mm.
And I really do have seasonal depression.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
So I am hoping for some warm fuzzies here in the near future.
Yeah. This winter has been rough.
Yeah.
For the Grim Gang.
The Grim Gang being you and I.
Yeah, the Grim Gang being us.
Us.
This winter has not treated us kindly.
No, this has been a fucking shithole of a winter.
So we're both just ready for flowers and sunshine.
Uh-huh.
I was thinking the other day, you know, I can't wait for a Sunday morning to come around when we record and we can like go sit on my patio again with like a screwdriver, Bloody Mary.
Yep.
And chit chat in the sunshine before we record one day. Like
so
that
nice.
Thought alone brought me so much joy. That I was like, okay, we just gotta get there. That's
we
what I want.
We just gotta get there. I want a day at the winery and cute sundresses.
Yes. Oh my God.
I would like walk through the woods.
Yes. We should make like a summer bucket list.
Yes.
Even if it's just like small things, like go walk in the woods, winery day.
Yep.
Let's do it.
Okay.
And we need to stick to it.
Yep.
We deserve that.
Yeah, I agree. We'll do that.
I like it.
We get one event every 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love.
Okay. If anybody like wants to tell us what we should do this summer.
Yeah.
What's your favorite like summer joy activity? Let us know.
Yes. I love that.
And now.
Into the story. What do you want to go first? Do you want me to go first?
I don't care. You go first.
Okay. So I thought I would bring it back to like a fun herbal.
Yeah.
Like.
Are you telling us
history?
About Mother Earth?
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to tell you about rosemary today.
Yes. Okay.
All right. So rosemary is most commonly found in the Mediterranean region. Just some stone cold facts for you.
Okay.
Rosemary is a fragrant evergreen herb and is used for culinary means to make bodily perfumes and for various health benefits. The name rosemary derives from the Latin for dew or rose and sea, or which basically is dew of the sea, and is also sometimes called anthos, which is the Greek word meaning flower.
Oh.
Rosemary also has a fibrous root system and is a great source of iron, calcium, and vitamin B6.
Love that.
Rosemary is traditionally used to help alleviate muscle pain, improve memory, boost the immune and circulatory system, and promote hair growth, and is still being used for these reasons today.
Hair growth?
Yeah. So if you, I've noticed in, like, I used a lot of, like, oils and stuff in my hair when I started losing my hair, like, psycho 9 months ago or whatever. And rosemary was a common ingredient.
Did it help?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, like,
I've got... My hair is thinning right now, but I think it's because of the stress.
Oh, yeah. Mine was, I went off birth control.
Oh,
and
that'll do it.
I lost my mind about how much hair I was losing.
Yeah.
Genuinely.
Yeah,
freaked out by it. Rosemary is beneficial for healing due to its rich source of antioxidants and anti-inflammatory compounds, thought to help boost the immune system and improve blood circulation. This helps fight free radicals, which can make it helpful in fighting various diseases.
Yeah.
In Europe, rosemary was used to help treat indigestion, and in Germany's Commission E has approved it for treatment of dyspepsia. I don't know what that is.
Cool.
Though it is still yet to be majorly studied for these purposes. Studies have also illustrated rosemary's effect on the brain, as it contains carnosic acid, which enables it to fight off free radical damage. This acid has also been shown to improve eye health.
Wow.
I know.
So good for your body and soul.
So many uses. In addition, a study in Cell Journal found that it may be helpful in using, or may be useful in protecting against beta amyloid-induced neurodegeneration in the hippocampus.
Oh,
woof.
Good job.
Thank you. Another study published in Bioscience, Biotechnology, and Biochemistry said that rosemary may be an effective herbal anti-inflammatory and anti-tumor agent.
Wow.
So rosemary is either used as an herb in food or is extracted as an oil to use in medicines, both topically and orally. It is related to the third eye chakra in helping promote spiritual clarity and some magical properties. This herb's magic properties are used for love spells, protection, and as an aphrodisiac. In ancient times, it was favored for purification and cleansing rituals. And it is considered one of the best tonics for the central nervous system because it acts as a brain stimulant and has a long history of improving memory, aiding in psychic protection and intuition.
Mm.
It inspires the love of self and others and strengthens the willpower, according to Dr. Glynis Rogerson, PhD. In his article, Davis suggests that it strengthens the heart. It may be considered a middle-aged executive's best friend.
Wow.
According to legend, it was draped around the Greek goddess Aphrodite when she rose from the sea. And then the Virgin Mary is said to have spread her blue cloak over a white blossomed rosemary bush when she was resting and the flowers turned blue. And from then on, the shrub was referred to as the Rose of Mary.
Oh, interesting.
Isn't that cool? Rosemary's healing powers have been celebrated throughout the world. In the Middle Ages, rosemary was associated with wedding ceremonies where the bride would wear a rosemary headpiece and the groom and the wedding guests would all wear a sprig of rosemary. From then on, it became associated with love. And how to use it in magic. In old world magic, rosemary was burned to purify a room or ritual space before performing any magic. Rosemary put into a bath or tea can help with removing anxiety and invigorating and cleansing the spirit. To ensure a faithful husband, married women should keep a sachet of rosemary near the entrance of their homes. It is also used in spells for fidelity and ridding of jealousy. Like lavender, rosemary is placed under the pillow to promote peaceful sleeping and ward off evil spirits and nightmares.
Cute.
So that's rosemary.
I love that. You got to keep doing those.
I like them. They're fun.
They're fun. I'm going to tell you about a little baby crime.
Okay.
At about 4:55 p.m.,
uh-huh.
After setting off bombs in two cars at hotels nearby as a distraction for the police, a man armed with a submachine gun accompanied by two men with handguns threatened the guards and made off with three paintings at the Swiss National Museum.
Oh, shit.
The robbers escaped by throwing nails onto the road to hinder police cars.
Oh, my God.
Fleeing in a motorboat they had moored in a nearby waterway. In January 2001, the police received a ransom demand for the several million kroner from a lawyer acting on behalf of the thieves with photos of the paintings to prove it was real, but they refused to pay. Also in January, the masterminds of the scheme, Alexander Petrov and Stefan Nordstrom, as well as the lawyer who acted on their behalf as a negotiator, and several other accomplices were arrested, which led to the conviction of Petrov, Nordstrom, and three others in July of the same year. Despite the arrest, the police would not recover any of the paintings until 2 months later, when they recovered conversation in an unrelated drug raid. Right. The official police statement on the raid stated, "We weren't looking for the painting, so it was a bonus when we found it."
Love that. Accidental founding.
A little art heist for you.
Oh, my gosh.
Just a small little one.
Little
art heist.
I love the art heists. You should bring back a true crime art heist.
I was thinking about it.
I think I saw one, and I should have sent it to you.
Yeah, I love them. I think they're super cool. The more, like, mastermind-y, the better.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so I have a crime for you as well.
Okay.
This is not a baby crime. This could have almost been a full true crime episode, but not quite. So buckle up.
Okay.
All right. June 12th, 2012, Danielle Hawkins was arrested for a type of student abuse not many would suspect to be under the list of teacher crimes. Hawkins is the Florida teacher who forced students to participate in demonic rituals.
What?
Specifically one involving fires and self-mutilation.
What?
It's the kind of insane story about teachers who abuse their students that grips the nation for a millisecond before the news cycle turns over, but Danielle Hawkins' crimes need further examination because of how strange they are. There are many stories about teachers with violent students or the truly horrifying things teachers have to deal with, but in this case, it was the teacher committing a series of truly gruesome acts on her pupils.
Wow.
Hawkins was a literacy teacher working with a group of Florida teens. On June 9th, 2012, she told seven teens that they had demons inside of them, and the only way to free themselves of these negative entities was to slice open their skin and then cauterize the wounds.
What?
While no one knows why she committed these harmful occult activities with her group of students, many cite her dissolving marriage, eventual divorce, and custody battle over her children as the catalyst for her unhinged rituals that would end in two students being badly burned. At dusk on June 9th, Harkins started a small fire near the St. Petersburg Pier. The 35-year-old literacy teacher at the Lealman and Asian Neighborhood Family Center was preparing a cleansing ritual for herself and some of her former students. When the handful of students arrived, she told them that there were demons living in their bodies, and the only way to exorcise them was for Hawkins to cut her former students open and cauterize their wounds. Police spokesman Mike Pewitz said, "There was apparently some chanting and then dancing around the fire that was taking place, and then Hawkins instructed the teens to slice each other open while she used a lighter to burn their wounds."
Whoa.
During the ritual, Hawkins used a lighter in an attempt to brand one of her former students. After the wind blew out the flame, she decided to pour perfume on him as an accelerant, and her plan worked too well. The fire was so intense that it caused second-degree burns on the student's hand. Another student received a slash on the throat from a jagged piece of a broken bottle. After cutting the student, Hawkins used a burning key to cauterize their wounds. A spokesperson for the police said that the students who participated in the ritual were loyal to their teacher and keeping mum about the event. Many believe that the catalyst for the blood ritual that sent Hawkins to jail was the divorce of her husband, George. The two didn't have a healthy marriage by a long shot. Prior to the divorce, she took her husband to court for domestic dispute that was dismissed. So she was definitely dealing with a series of emotional issues.
Yeah.
Along with the stress of the recent divorce, Hawkins had allegedly started getting into religion.
Mm.
Her neighbor, Lisa Cope, claims that one day Hawkins stopped by to tell the poor woman that she was okay and that she didn't have any demons.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. The bizarre piece of this puzzle is how on board the students appeared to be with their ex-teacher. Even though she so obviously committed ritualistic abuse, they still didn't give any information to the police about her previous activity. The only student that offered anything to the press was Stephen Chanthamelia, 17, who said, "I'm fine. All I know is that she's in custody." Without any of the students coming forward and admitting to anything else happening to them, the only thing people can do is speculate on the nature of Harkin's crime. In the time that she had with the students, she was able to isolate and groom them into caring for her, or at least into believing all of her weird blood ritual talk. After the ritual ended, no one ran home to tell their parents or call the cops. It appeared that all of the students believed that what Mrs. Harkins was doing was completely normal. After the incident blew up in the press, many of the students present didn't even want to talk about the ritual or their former teacher. However, one of the students brought the ritual up to a friend after the night of the incident via text. That friend immediately told her parents, who called the police. It is possible that if one student hadn't have told their friend, Harkins would have continued this pattern of abuse until someone eventually died. Before she was leading teenagers into blood rituals to cleanse their bodies of demonic entities, Harkins was reportedly a normal person. She taught literacy at a community center in St. Petersburg, Florida, and was married with two kids. She was living the dream, but there was something awful brewing inside of her. Carolyn Chance, the administrator at the family center she worked at, described Harkins as a very good teacher. Chance said that she was very intelligent, she was very skilled. Just recently, she started exploring religion, but I didn't know anything about demons or anything like that. After the story of the teenage blood ritual got out, Harkins was arrested on one count of child abuse and one count of aggravated battery. She was put on leave from her teaching position and held on a $55,000 bail. At the time of her arrest, police were hoping that the students who were involved in the ritual would give them more information. If they were willing to let her cut them up and light them on fire, she was likely doing something else that they didn't know about. Unfortunately, none of the teens were talking, so no one knows what else might have been happening. As of 2014, Harkins was released from prison and is on her own recognizance.
Wow.
After serving 6 months total for child abuse and paying thousands of dollars in court and bond fees, Harkins was released from prison and disappeared. A local Fox affiliate in St. Petersburg went to her house and rang her doorbell, but Harkins never answered. It is unlikely she will ever discuss what led her to cutting up her former students in a blood ritual on a pier.
Yeah, I would doubt that she would ever speak on that.
Yeah, so. Yeah.
Oh, right. Shit.
So that was a Ranker article by Jacob Shelton.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. I also have an article out of Portland, Oregon that was posted by Wayne TV, our local news station. So, a major eruption on the far side of the sun created one of the largest coronal mass ejections in recent years. With an eruption of this magnitude, the Earth dodged a bullet, quite literally, according to Jim Todd, the director of space science education at the Orkin Museum of Science and Industry. We saw a very large coronal mass ejection, which is a major storm on the sun. It happened on the far side, which is awfully good because it was enormous. Through the explosive CME is not expected to strike Earth. Images captured by satellites and seismic mapping showing the sheer size of the eruption had many people talking. Todd's and scientists estimate the flare stretched to roughly 400,000 kilometers, which is greater than the distance between the Earth and the moon. According to Todd, CME events of this magnitude are caused when the negative and positive charges within the electromagnetic field on the sun contradict, resulting in a powerful discharge of sunspots. Todd said CME events and sun flares are not independently surprising, though the scale of this explosion would pose a serious threat to Earth had our planet been in the direct line of fire. So what are we worried about and why are we talking about it? Todd posed. If this storm was headed towards Earth, it would have caused a massive worldwide aurora effect, which some say would represent similarities to the 1859 Carrington event. The Carrington event of 1859 was a major CME event that impacted Earth and essentially knocked out all telegraphs. With the advancement of technology since then, Todd said a similar event today could be catastrophic and potentially shut off most forms of all electronics. Ooh.
If this storm was directed our way, it very easily could have knocked down some of the satellites, power grids, cell phones, the list goes down. We would be more vulnerable now with all the digital technology we have come to love and use. Todd said we're lucky scientists continue to monitor this type of solar activity. Based on data tracking, Todd said we can predict trends in solar activity and better prepare for impact if needed. According to Solar Trends, Todd said we are actively heading into a time frame of increased solar activity. We're going from a solar minimum into our solar maximum, Todd said. In 2022, the sunspot counts have gone way up. And in 2020 and 2019, the sun was very quiet with little activity. The data pattern follows an 11-year cycle, which expands and contracts, he continued. And we're just starting the peak. So we're going to see this kind of activity for the next couple of years.
Although it's still early, Todd said scientists have theorized that this week's CME may have been linked to the same Jupiter-sized sunspot that generated a geomagnetic storm on February 4th and took out 40 SpaceX satellites.
Cool shit.
Many scientists believe that the storm that we saw yesterday was related to the same sunspot. The latitude level looks like this is at the very same spot, so they're expecting as it comes around in the next few days, we may see that the spot is still active and can erupt again, so we need to be watching this. Todd said the sunspot will be back in Earth's view within the next 11 days. He warned that the public try not and look for the spot without the use of solar viewing glasses.
Sure.
As it may cause permanent eye damage. Uh-huh.
Don't look at the sun, you idiot. Yeah.
Fucking window licker. Depending on where you live, Todd said, parts of Earth may be able to view remnants of the flare in the form of auroras. According to Todd, it would take about 3 to 4 days for CME waves to hit the Earth. Until then, he told the news outlet that he's grateful scientists are continuing to monitor the activity. This is a huge storm. Does it surprise us? No. But there's always the question of what comes next. All these observatories are monitoring the sun for us, and they're doing a great job. We're learning from it. Hopefully, we'll be ready.
Oh my gosh.
That was just like last week.
Shit.
Yeah.
Dang it. Well. Nothing like World War III and sunspots.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah.
So I have a fun obituary for you.
Oh God. Okay.
All right. Rick Stein, 71, of Wilmington, was reported missing and presumed dead on September 27th, 2018, when investigators say that the single-engine plane he was piloting, the Northrop, suddenly lost communication with air traffic control and disappeared over the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Rehoboth Beach. Philadelphia police confirmed Stein had been a patient at St. Thomas University Hospital, where he was being treated for a rare form of cancer. Hospital spokesperson Walter Heisenberg says doctors from Stein's surgical team went to visit him on rounds when they discovered his room was empty. Security footage shows Stein leaving the building at approximately 3:30 Thursday afternoon, but the video fed mysteriously cut off. Authorities say that they believe Stein took an Uber to the Philadelphia airport, where they assume he somehow gained access to an aircraft. The sea was angry that day, the NTSB lead investigator Greg Fields said in a press conference. We have no idea where Mr. Stein may be, but any hope for a rescue is unlikely. Stein's location isn't the only mystery. It seems no one in his life actually knew what his occupation was. His daughter, Alex Walsh of Wilmington, appeared shocked by the news. My dad couldn't even fly a plane. He owned restaurants in Boulder, Colorado, and knew every answer to Jeopardy. He did the New York Times crossword in Penn. I talked to him that day, and he told me he was going out to get some grappa. He never wanted, all he ever wanted was a glass of grappa. I don't know what that is. Stein's brother, Jim, echoed a similar confusion. Rick and I owned Stuart Kingston Galleries together. He was a jeweler, an oriental rug dealer, not a pilot.
What?
Meanwhile, Miss L. Leddington of Charlottesville claimed her brother was a cartoonist and freelance television critic for The New Yorker. David Walsh, Stein's son-in-law, said he was certain Stein was a political satirist for The Huffington Post, while grandsons Drake and Sam said that they believe Stein wrote the internet sports column for ESPN covering Duke basketball.
Is this real?
Okay. FC Barcelona Soccer and the Denver Broncos and the Tour de France. Stein's granddaughter, Evangeline, claims that he was a YouTube sensation who had just signed a 7-figure deal with Netflix. When told of his uncle's disappearance, Edward Stein said that he was baffled since he believed Stein worked as a trail guide in the Rocky Mountains National Park. He took me up a hike up the Lily Peak Trail back in the 90s. He knew every berry, bush, and tree on that trail. Nephew James Stein of Los Angeles claimed his uncle was an A&R consultant for the Bad Boy Records and ran a chain of legal recreational marijuana dispensaries in Colorado called Casablanca. Niece Courtney Stein, a former Hollywood agent, said her uncle had worked as a contributing writer for Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm and was currently consulting on a new series with Larry David. People who knew Stein have reported his occupation as everything from gourmet chef and sommelier to botanist, electrician, mechanic, and even spy novelist. Police say that the volume of contradictory information will make it nearly impossible to pinpoint Stein's exact location.
No shit.
In fact, the only person who might be able to answer this question, who is the real Rick Stein, is his wife and constant companion for the past 14 years, Susan Stein. Detectives say that they were unable to interview Mrs. Stein. However, neighbors say that they witnessed her leaving her home, the couple shared, wearing dark sunglasses and a fedora, loading multiple suitcases into her car. FAA records show she purchased a pair of one-way tickets to Rome, which was Mr. Stein's favorite city. An anonymous source with the airline reports the name used to book the other ticket was Juan Morfor de Rode, which, according to the FBI, was an alias Stein used for many years.
Juan Morfor de Rode.
And that is one story. Another story is that Rick never left the hospital and died peacefully with his wife and his daughters, holding tightly to his hands. You can choose which version you want to believe, or share your own story about Rick with us at the Greenville County Country Club on Friday, November 9th from 3 to 6 p.m., or at the Hollywood Boldero on Thursday, November 9th from 3 to 6 p.m.
That's going to make me cry.
I know. I love
that.
That's
them. Amazing. And, you know, they had to pay for word on that, too.
Oh, for sure.
They got money. You would have had to do all those things.
I know. But it's just, I love that they... That was how they, like, listed his family,
yeah.
too, was, like, what every person believed
he did.
What a sweet
That is
thing.
So fun. What a cool family. Oh, my God. I love that. Good job. Good Thanks. Find. Good find. I have a story.
Oh, okay.
I have a story. So settle in.
All right. One. I'm ready.
It's called The Eternal Woman.
Okay.
And it's by Simon Simonian.
Ooh.
I know. Every now and then, curious passerby press their foreheads against the rusty gates of the garden, desperately squinting through the mist. None dare to climb over and enter. In the middle of the dazed garden stands this four-storied cadaver of a building. Years ago, it was home to many residents, a couple of families, a few students, some retirees. Now the house is nothing more than a decrepit panorama for bleak clouds. Wild toflax spreads through the splintered masonry, covering its windows with ladylike fingers. Some branches diffuse through cracks in the windows, other back towards the upward, the roof tiles, dangling on the other side like marionettes. Ornamenting the somber palette of ossified colors, the house has lulled itself to sleep with memories of its past, not even disturbed by thuds of dry acorns on the cracked cement path. Time has stopped here. You too have been passing by, peeking through the gates, wandering about the empty garden in the house. And like everyone else, you too never dared to enter, until now, with your face pressed against the gates. You notice something in one of the second floor windows, a speck of light, a tiny one. You cup your hands and squint through the mist, and there it is again. What was that all about, you wonder, and after all, the house has been abandoned for 30 years now, and to your knowledge, no one set foot inside ever since. That's when curiosity finally prevails over apprehension and common sense, and so you make that decision. You look around to make sure no one is watching you, and you climb on top of the gate, carefully make your way above its gothic serration, then jump 7 feet down to the cemented path of the garden. The light in the window still shimmers, flashing its gaze like a beacon from an abandoned lighthouse. Then slowly you make your way across the forking path through the garden towards the house, and your steps are quiet and soft as you are trying to not wake a sleeping banshee. You pass by the fountain bench, noticing some random penchants of the past. A book that must have left by a scatterbrained resident, or a gardener glove tucked between moldy pebbles. The ghastly mist disperses as you reach the entrance of the house. You stomp your feet to shake juniper needles out of your shoes, and that's when you hear it. It's the house cringing in its sleep. As you put your foot on the first stair, you can feel it breathe faster and shift eyelids side to side. It must be finally noticing your presence. The second stair, and the house no longer reacts to squeaks, but only shivers with its myriads of entangled spider webs. Like a comatose patient, it momentarily opens its eyes, gapes around with multiple eye sockets, and falls back into vegetative slumber. One flight of stairs, and the door to your left is the one you need. It's not locked, and you try to push it, and after a few tries, the door finally huffs and gives in. Swarms of microscopic dust specks perform pirouettes around you in all directions before fading from sight, beckoning you, the intruder, to enter the sanctuary presided by darkness. You hesitate, but you step in. You light a match, and molecules of light bounce off the walls, revealing the long corridor, seemingly longer than the building itself. How? Oh, there's another door to your left, so you try the knob, but it's locked. Next to the door, you notice a coat rack with nothing on it but a little headscarf. And to your right, you see what looks like a kitchen with a bathroom pod and piles of some debris. Don't go in there. Just keep walking straight. The corridor soon ends and you come face to face with a wide set of double doors. It's time you open them with ease. Welcome to the living room. Whatever sunlight penetrates through the dappled window is not enough for you to see anything. You light another match and look around and you see rows of books with eroded titles stacked on the shelves. Then further down, an open piano looking like a smiling imbecile with missing front teeth. Then a carcass of once was a desk. Random wood planks covering its frame and a sooty glass face and an armchair facing the opposite way. Wait, you think you see somebody sitting in that armchair. You hold your breath. Who's there? You whisper. Taking cautious sideways steps, you walk around, maintaining a distance or a few feet between yourself and the figure in the armchair. You can hear your own heart pounding against your chest cage, and trickles of sweat run down your brows, and you don't notice the match burning your fingertips. You twitch and lick your finger. You pick your last match. Yes, only one left in the matchbox. You nervously rub it against the side of your matchbox 3 or 4 times until it finally draws aerial hues in the air. As the sulfur's light once again illuminate the living room, you find yourself standing right in front of that someone. That someone is still sitting in the armchair. That someone is looking right at you. That someone is me. I am a girl about 6 or 7 years old, and I live here.
Oof.
Those are my books, and that vase belongs to me, true. I tried learning piano once, only to be driven away by its constant throating mocking of my poor skills, and I give up. And now the piano is nothing but a quiet observance of my daily routine. Speaking of routine, it consists of sitting in this old armchair, leaning my palms on the armrest, swooning in and out of existence. My whole existence is waiting.
Josephine! Green bean, quit it.
Who do I wait for? I wait for her, the elderly woman who lives in the other room. I wait for her to call upon me. And so I sit and I stare at the dim window, looking from the rear side of the building. There are trees that grow there, and from time to time I see blotchy specks of sunlight slicing through that evergreen maze of conifers. Other than that, nothing is happening. No visitors, no intruders, only in my imagination, including you. Evening creeps in, drawing strange gallows on the ceiling, and when it gets darker, I hear thousands of voices oscillating through the corridor and the room and the imbecile piano and the armchair. The voices, cognizant of my presence, intensify like a pendulum in reverse motion, calling me by my name. These are the voices of the yore, of places and sounds and smells, names long forgotten, eclipsing slowly like smoldering grass. This quiet peace is only disturbed by the clamor of the dripping faucet in the kitchen every hour, and pacing of the elderly woman in the adjacent room. She paces from one corner to another, and I dare not enter her room. Not until she calls me. And that's when I suddenly hear it. At first it sounds like a distant moan, but then it's there again, this time a bit more pronounced. I move towards the door of my sanctuary in my living room, and I stand by the doorstep and I hear it again, this time much clearer. Child. This cannot be a mistake. It's her. Goodbye, piano. Goodbye, armchair. Goodbye, books. I float down the corridor, gently caressing the ceiling with my hair as I come closer to the bedroom. The voice resonates with overlaying echoes. Child. And dormant echoes retort to her in their peculiar unison. The door to her bedroom is locked, but it isn't locked for me, and I open and float into her room, hovering above the floor like an apparition. Faint light from a lantern situated on a nightstand is enough to only uncover a few feet of the room. And one may wonder if this is the same light that beacons through the window, inviting adventurous intruders. As I enter the old woman's room, I gaze through the sumptuously furnished room down to the arabesque wall tapestry with arching necks of draped chandeliers. I've never been here before, and my childish curiosity takes over. Below the tattered decorations of oval coving, I notice old photographs hung on manifold nooks, and the aura above the lantern gives some unwanted colors to the otherwise black and white photographs. I notice sallow inscriptions in the corner of each photograph, and I try to read it first, but I hear a voice reading it for me. Jacob F. Haynes. I turn to the far corner of the room where the voice came from. It must be her, the elderly woman sitting in the armchair in the dark corner of the room. Jacob F. Haynes, says the voice again. That's the name of the photographer, the person who took that photo. The first photograph on the right was taken in March of 1932, me and my brother Henry, the very year he died. We grew up in a much larger house by the Delmar Gardens off Morgan Street, a big patio with, there's that patio in the photograph to the left. Her croaky sentences finally cease, and I can feel her shivering stare through the brown darkness. I can hear her taking loud sips of breath between words like ebb and tide of an ancient ocean, and if I take another step, I will see her face, but she stops me and commands me to take a seat on the ottoman. My name is Adrienne, she says. I was only 9 when Henry died. She pauses to repel the sudden onslaught of painful memories and takes a deep breath and slowly goes on. My brother Henry was always an ill boy, but before the Great Depression hit, he was not something we worried about. Father's business was blooming, we had access to the best specialists, enough money for expensive prescriptions. Then, when the trouble came and the business that we owned slowly but surely went up in smoke, the photograph in the upper left, yes, that one, it's my father in front of our old house. We sold it the next year, and I cried, and so did my mother, even when she tried to soothe me. That's when we moved here, to the second floor apartment in this residential building. This is my room, mine and Henry's. He slept right there, exactly at the same spot where those photographs are. While we tried to make ends meet, his disease only got worse, and doctors gave it a medical name, polio. Other doctors gave it a scary nickname, plague of the century, and they told my father that Henry had to be hospitalized. He died on Christmas Day. His body, weakened from numerous childhood illnesses, could not withstand another challenge. He was lucky. I knew he was. Others like him that I saw in the hospital lived on. Children of his age, some older, some younger, they were being placed in wooden boxes where nurses stimulated their lungs to breathe. They called it iron lungs, and it was supposed to save them, but it only inflicted more pain. Henry never went through that. He was lucky. He died peacefully on Silent Night. She stops again. Emotions must have combed through her throat, weakening tongue muscles for a moment, but she knows she has very little time left. In her words like columns of blind men meander towards me, never breaking formation. The photograph in the middle of me and my mother in 1944 at the train station. A few days after we received the Western Union telegram from Adjutant General, who was deeply saddened to inform us that my father, who was previously reported missing in action, was killed in Holland. The day after we received the death telegram, I informed my mother that I was joining the military. She did not try to dissuade me. I remember her look, like an abyss staring back at you. We stood at the train station and posed for one final photo. That photo right there. And then I was off on the train in the naval base in Newfoundland. Then across the Atlantic to tread on the battlegrounds where my father once fought. Military nurse, Army Nurse Corps, blue khaki olive uniforms. And then the war was over. That photograph below, that's me in Paris, 1945, late spring. Flowers that they used to sell only on Rue de Lyon. His door with the cowbell rang that made me laugh, and I can hear it now, the putrid stench of the nearby canal. I can smell it. The loaves he baked for me with shelled peas, and he called it poipon. I can still taste it, and the way he looked at me when I came by their family bakery and rang that cowbell and asked for another piece of bread, and the secret signal that he and I only shared. I cherished it. The alcove where we met under the pillows of lilac and my name that he pronounced so funny. It made me smile. The letters we wrote to each other with those strange curves he would put above vowels or that made his handwriting so special. And then our dreams. Our funny dreams that whirled in the air, tap danced on monastery towers before dispersing into the lagoon sky. She looks at the tall clock on the other side of the room. It doesn't work. She knows that. But old reflexes are hard to break. She coughs and hollow echoes play parrot to her. The photograph on the top right, 1947, me back in this apartment after 3 years of being away, like a pebble thrown in the air, came back to say goodbye to mother. The tumor they found in her skull was supposed to keep her alive for only 1 month, enough for me to come back and lay her down to rest. But she lived for 2 years. It was just the two of us in this apartment, me and her tumor. We shared our days in this room, sometimes walking downstairs or glistening under the fountain in the garden. Me reading, the tumor nodding and asking me for a release. I refused to grant one. Tumor understood and obeyed. He spoke to the apathy in her eyes and to the tumor. The fountain water would occasionally splash dead mosquitoes on her gray dress, and I wiped them. And from time to time, she tried to talk, but that sounded only like croaking followed by a gasping cough and drooling. My 1 month return home turned into 2 years, which then turned into a lifetime. I stayed by her side all the time. I stayed when she passed on, and I stayed thereafter. That photograph. Yes, 1959, oily and yellow. The last photograph of me and the last of this building while it was still alive. A few years before that, I managed to buy the building from previous owners for a very cheap price. They wanted to sell it quickly, and frankly, no one was interested in buying an old, decrepit house. No one but me. Little by little, all residents have moved out. You can see that the house in the background in that photograph, only our window was lit. The others are dark. Like an eternal pendulum, I remained the sole beating heart of the house. Hollow echoes the room in the room cough harder, turning the mirror-bound space into a compilation of sibulating blasts. She plays parrot with them, and I am sensing the end. Child, come closer. She is lifting the sateen veil off of her face and for a moment stares into the emptiness of the room with memories curling up like coils of white smoke. Then drifting towards me, I catch them all. I am gliding right above her. I'm imbibing her memories, and I am an infant popping soap bottles. Her last thoughts are pulsating like conclusion baritone of the tall clock, pushing into its final slow motion ticks. I can hear her. Time. It plays with musical notes on her face, hops between waves into the parched shells of her lips, toys with the crest of her wrinkles, and then gears upwards with hissing sighs. And I come closer. Until my curls become hers, until my young body and hers become one. Her voice, her face, and that empty apathy in her eyes turns into a childish curiosity. Blooming flowers tessellate the raptured skin like a warm spring after a dry winter, and the world is new again. The house takes its last breath and dies. The elderly woman's head rests on the armchair, and they die together, and the speck of light slowly floats out of her chest towards me. I reach out and I catch it. The speck of light. The same one that you, the intruder, saw moments ago behind the gate. The same light that ignited your curiosity and made you climb over the gates, through the misty garden, down the forking path to the staircase, upstairs to the apartment, through the corridor, to this very room, only to find nothing in here. But by then I will be already gone. I have already bid my farewell to the dead house and parted with the garden and the gates and the needled junipers and the derelict fountain. I am outside the gates now. I stride merrily down the street to the market square on my way to the new life. I am ready to live again. I am alive. My name is Adrian. I am 6 or 7. A little Grim Reaper-y reincarnation. Yeah. Little creepy crawly story for you.
Ooh, that was good.
Thanks. It's long, but it just is like haunting.
Yeah, very spooky, the whole thing.
I like
good
it.
Good job.
Thank you.
Very nice.
A lot of words in there.
Yeah. I like it.
Thank you.
So do you have a bright and shiny for today?
My bright and shiny is that Ian and I had dinner at a bowling alley yesterday and I did not get food poisoning.
I love that for you. Good
Thank
job.
You. Thank you so much. I've got a stomach of steel.
Yes, you do.
What's your bright and shiny?
My bright and shiny is that I'm going to lunch today with the fam for my stepsister's birthday.
Fun. Yeah. Which one?
Caitlin. Yes.
Very fun.
Yeah, we're going to go to Biaggi's for lunch.
Ooh, I love just casual Biaggi's.
Yes. They have such good bread.
Do they?
Yeah.
I could go for some Ziano's.
Ooh.
Ziano's breadsticks.
Yeah, they do have good breadsticks there too.
Yeah. Nice. Anyway, follow us on the Sochmeads.
Yeah.
And do the things. If you like what you hear, leave us a review.
Super, super appreciate it.
Some like spooky whack shit has ever happened to you, send it to us. We would also like to know about the
Your
weird
spooky shit.
Yeah, tell us.
Yes.
We beg.
We demand. We boss.
We
actually. This is
we
not
gatekeep.
A request.
We girl boss. Do it. Do it right out. Stop your bubble bath or whatever you're doing.
Yeah. Demand. Pull over.
We have to be nice.
I know.
If you feel like it, you can.
I guess. It's all right.
And also, if you feel like it, you should be kind to yourself.
And to others.
Goodbye.